Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and happy Father's Day weekend, everybody. If that is your jam, if you were blessed to have a good dad, if you are a good dad, if you're not a good dad, what are you doing? Go fuck yourself. Get out of here. This is for the good ones. Is this a good way to open a podcast, especially right before a holiday weekend? Is it really a holiday? What am I doing? You know, this feeds really well into something that I was talking about with my therapist the other day. Yeah, I got a therapist. Brag. I was talking to my therapist the other day about the fact that I had spent most of my life as some kind of entertainer. And as such, I was very busy, I was very focused, and I didn't have a lot of time for friendships. And, you know, I've been accused of being a little, I don't know how to phrase this. It's not my phrasing, but I've been accused of being a little spectrum-y, perhaps having some mild level of Asperger's or something. And I can't really refute that. But, you know, I never really learned how to have normal, I guess whatever you would call normal, relationships with other people. I was in bands. I was in stage plays. I was in movies. You know, I did all that stuff, but I didn't really do a lot of just going to parties and hanging out and, you know, going to concerts and sitting on the porch drinking and backyard barbecues. I didn't do a lot of that. In fact, almost none of that. And anytime I did do it, I felt really awkward about it. And now I'm more or less a pretty well-functioning adult, but it's a skill that I had to acquire. It's something I had to figure out how to do because it was important to me. It was important to me to be able to connect with other human beings because I realized that I was very sad and very lonely, and I had no idea how to interact with other humans, and I wanted some kind of a connection so badly. But how do you do that? Especially when you're a grown adult and you've never really developed those skills. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've gone through a lot of failure. It's not that I haven't, you know, gone out and failed and dusted myself off and tried again, but there's something different about putting yourself out there wholeheartedly. There's something a lot more vulnerable, something a lot more scary. It's a lot easier for someone to not like you because you're on stage bombing at stand-up comedy. Or someone doesn't like you because you're a bad musician or they don't like what you're doing. Someone doesn't like you because they saw the movie you were in and it sucked. That's all pretty easy to take. At least for me it is. I don't take that stuff to heart. I mean, because at the end of the day, I made stuff. I did things, and, you know, I'm always trying to do more and better, but it hasn't really ever occurred to me how to take that next step into being that open to whatever comes with another human being. That's a difficult thing for me. I've got a handful of people in my life that I really trust and that I really care about. And I'm working on it because I do realize that I still have a tendency to isolate and keep myself away from other people. And I know I've talked about that a little bit on the show before, but having conversations with people in the studio is not a substitute for a human interaction. It's not a substitute for friendships. And the thing about friendships is you're going to get hurt. At some point, people are going to go away. People are going to grow apart. You're going to have fights, especially if you get in close with somebody. You're going to have some fights. But all of that is worth human interaction and human contact. Just because you've been hurt before is no reason to say fuck it and throw it all away. Now, why do I bring all that up? I'll tell you why. Because when today's guest came into the studio to have this conversation, we didn't know each other very well at all. In fact, I did not know her at all. I'd never met her face to face. We had never really had a conversation other than scheduling. And I didn't know what we were going to be getting into. And she sat across from me and made a decision about who I was, what level of trust I could be given with this story that she was going to tell, and rolled the dice on that and opened up a level of vulnerability that most people don't get from a close friend. And honestly, I was a little struck by it. I'm struck by it every time somebody talks to me in here. But you know, there was something about this one that clicked for me. After hearing everything that this person had gone through, after hearing all of the stories and of everything that she had been through, all of the hardship, all of the times humanity absolutely failed her, and she picked herself up and dusted herself off and said, you know what? Let's try this again tomorrow. If she can go through all of that and still come out the other side with a bruised, heavy, hopeful heart that things can be better, I think maybe there's hope for me too. I think maybe I don't have to be quite so cynical. I don't have to be quite so worried. I don't have to believe that humanity is a problem, that you always have to be ready for the other shoe to drop. You always have to be ready for pain and people to disappoint you. You can choose to go another way. You can absolutely choose. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. Let's talk to Vanessa Hart. The levels are good, so yeah, we're solid. So hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
What's your morning been like so far? The weather's been a little unpredictable here lately.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of over the rain. I wasn't expecting it today.
Yeah, it made it hard to get out of bed for me. I was just sleepy.
I wake up every morning at like 7 to 8 a.m. and have a hard time getting any sleep past then, so.
Yeah, do you go to bed early, like responsibly and all that, or?
I should. I need to.
Yeah. So, tell me a little bit about where you're from. Are you from here in Colorado?
I grew up in Florida until I was about 8, and then my mom moved me over to California. We kind of lived all over throughout there. At 15, she sent me to Germany to see my family and spend the summer with them while she moved all of our things to Colorado.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Florida?
Oh, I mean, definitely the lifestyle. I mean, you know, back then I was a kid, it was the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, my dad had long hair that he put in a ponytail and a long pinky nail, which I always was like, what is that about? And now I'm older. I'm like, is that what I think it was?
Yeah. Dad was getting down.
Maybe. It was Miami. Mm. In the 80s.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so from Miami to California, I mean, what kind of kid were you?
Latchkey kid.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, my dad was very abusive physically to my mother. He's also emotionally abusive. He's a pretty terrible person, in my opinion, but he's very charming. Mm-hmm. I would say he's a psychopath.
You see that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that really charming people are abusive, and that's kind of how they get away with it.
Yeah, and he's a very charming, handsome, you know, very suave kind of person, but he's, you know, in a lot of ways I would consider evil, and some of the ways he's, you know, treated people. And of course, it's always like when you say something to someone and they know him, they're like, oh, I mean, I've never seen that. He seems like a nice guy. I'm like, uh-huh.
Yeah. That's like, the whole that's point.
It's like, that's what he wants you to think. That's, yeah. So when my mom and him divorced, after a few years, we moved to California. And my mom's not from this country. She's from Germany. She just didn't understand that some things aren't done the same in this country as they are there. So, you know, in this country, you don't really just, like, let your kid run around and expect your kid to, like, at, like, a very young age, just be like, here, you're on your own. Like,
yeah.
Go to school and then, like, you know, figure it out. Learn how to cook, like, everything. So, right. I really had to become independent at a very young age.
Yeah. So, how many years did you have to watch what was happening to your mom? How old were you when they split?
I think I was about 4. And then he was still around for a few years. There was some situations where, as an adult now, I'm like, oh, that's what happened. You know, like, he would drop me off to, or my mom would drop me off to spend the weekend with my dad. And then I'd hear screaming in the other room and didn't really know what happened. And as an adult, talking to my mom about it, I've kind of learned about some of the horrific things he did to her. And why, you know, she really wanted us to move out of the state. But then, you know, as a child, you know, you don't understand that maybe your father is evil or, you know, capable of, you know, like, it's like you see it, but you don't always understand it because, you know, my dad as a kid was really great to me. He used to, like, have a boat, take me swimming, all kinds of things. So, later in life, you know, when I became a teenager, it really became obvious, like, who that person was. And my childhood, you know, I never really thought was really affected by any of the things he did, but I always thought my childhood was more affected by the fact that I then had to be all alone, in a new state without any friends and with a mother who was very stressed out and working all the time. So, you know, as an only child, it was not an easy upbringing. Like, I had to pretty much raise myself.
If you think about it, that almost makes more sense that you would be more affected by being left alone than by witnessing the abuse, because you grew up with that. So that was, you know, I'm sure that you were consciously aware that something is wrong here.
Yeah.
But it was also your normal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as a kid, I just remember, like, tuning things out, like, literally, like, just humming really loud, you know, so I couldn't hear screaming and stuff and, you know, just some other things.
Putting
your
own coping mechanisms in place to keep you sane.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, even as a kid, you know, like, I was very well aware, like, that's not normal.
But it was still the situation that you had come to expect. I mean, after such a long time, that's kind of a fucked up thing to be, you know, brought up into, because it has to shape a lot of the ways you interact with other people and the world, because you have a certain expectation drilled into you somehow about how interpersonal relationships with people can go. So I would have to imagine that would put you at the ready.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's created trust issues. Mm-hmm. Like, even as a child, I didn't trust anybody.
Yeah.
And I've always been mistrustful of people. And I would love to be able to trust people. I would like to think that everyone's so inherently good, but it's just I've had so many situations where I really thought somebody was a certain way, and then turns out that they were putting on a facade.
Well, then you look at the world, and there's just so much evidence to the contrary. You know, it's really difficult to believe that people are inherently good. That's a mindset that you really have to cultivate. You have to put in the work to allow yourself to believe that. Mm-hmm. I feel like, and maybe that's just because I'm cynical, but it is something that I work on. You know, I work on the same thing. I didn't have quite the same issues. The thing that was happening in my house was my parents were really good to each other, but they were completely out of their mind, broke, too many kids. There were four of us, and my sisters were just causing them so many problems. And so there was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of conflict in the house growing up because nobody really liked each other, it didn't seem like. Oh. And so even to this day, I'm not close with my siblings. You know, there was actually a period of time where when people would ask me about my siblings, I would forget that I had a brother because we just, you know, we never clicked. Mm-hmm. It just never.
Was there like a lot of animosity?
Yeah, we hated each other. My brother was just a dick. it's a weird thing to say. I mean, now we've tried to reconnect as adults, you know, without all the baggage of childhood and, you know, the bullying and the weird power dynamics and stuff. We tried reconnecting as adults, but the thing is we just went such different directions that we became the kind of adults that wouldn't talk to each other if they weren't related. You know, a lot of people make concessions for family. So when people are tight with their siblings, I'm like, what's that like?
Yeah.
You know, but you were an only child. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you don't have any of that.
No. And not only that, but my mother's from Germany. Mm-hmm. So any family I have is in a foreign country and they speak a different language.
Oh,
and
right.
So, and then my father's side, I've never really known any of them. They're not probably the kind of people I would normally interact with.
Yeah.
You know, they're deep south. It's very different from, you know, my very liberal ways. You know, and then in Germany, you know, that's probably more of the interaction with family I've ever had, but it's difficult because, you know, I have an opa, my grandpa, but I can't communicate with him. I can't talk to him. I mean, the most communication we've had throughout our lives has mostly been things like, are you hungry? Do you want to eat something? like just like simple stuff, you know? And there's times where I just want to like talk to my opa. I know he's survived so much as a child in Germany. Actually, he's from a country that was basically absorbed during the war. So he was an immigrant to Germany because the country he was in was at war.
Oh, man.
So he really has been through a lot in his life, and he's a really amazing person. It always frustrates me that there's that language barrier.
Yeah.
And I spoke it fluently when I was a child, but after, you know, I hadn't gone to Germany from like 5 or 8 till 15, you know, I really had not had anyone to practice the language with. And my mother was always so busy and stressed out. It wasn't like there was an option for her to sit down and even ask me how my day was, let alone like help me with my homework or help me with like keeping my German in check. So
it was. Are you still in touch with your dad at all?
No, I disowned him a long time ago.
How did that go?
So any accomplishments I had when I was probably about 19, I started writing for a magazine. I was a model scout for Varla magazine, which was like a punk rock sort of punk rock and rock and roll, rockabilly, all, just any underground culture kind of music.
Cool.
And it was a magazine based on music and hot women. And it's definitely underground, and it was at a time before, you know, the internet exploded. So yeah. If you wanted to find anything cool and alternative, you probably read that magazine if you knew about it. And so I started writing for them when I was 18. I modeled for them at 18. By the time I was 19, I was still writing articles for them, and I was in college, and I had an interaction with my father, I think via the phone, and it was just like we had been not connected at all for a very long time, and you know, he called me one time and we were talking, and instead of, you know, saying he was proud of me for anything I did, I had a website at the time too, and he just insulted me and tore me down and was like, oh, you talk about wanting to be a writer. Like, why don't you write something? And I was like, I am a writer. Like, I've written several articles. So I was like, this is public knowledge. Like, you haven't even, like, looked me up on the website that I told you about, like, years before or, like, a year before. And it's just, like, very obvious that, like, no matter what I was ever going to do, that this person was just going to be a very toxic influence in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, at 19, I definitely was very rebellious, and I definitely was like, you know, you're not in my life, and you're not a good person, and I don't want that in my life.
And that had to be a tough call to make in spite of everything up to that point, because, I mean, I imagine your mom still felt strongly enough about the fact that, you know, even through what he was doing to her, that he be a part of your life.
Well, you know, she never really talked bad about him, because I guess she wanted me to establish my own opinion.
Right.
But he had done, in the few interactions I had with him as a teenager when I would fly out to see him, just the, ways that I would say he was cruel to me, were enough for me not to want this person in my life.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, he's not interested in getting to know me. He's just interested in controlling me. And I was very independent. So as a teenager, you know, I was I had raised myself. So then to then have an interaction with someone who doesn't know me, who then wants to control me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, I'm an adult.
Yeah.
Like, I've been an adult since I was like 9. So I don't need this person who doesn't know me at all to come in and try to insult me, tear me down. And at the time, I was putting myself through college. I was working night shifts, trying to get through school, crashing on people's couches because I didn't have money for an apartment, like struggling.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, if someone, it doesn't even matter if they're related to you, just anybody wants to tear you down, you don't need that in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing if it's a close friend and they're trying to help you in some way or create, you know, constructive criticism, but for someone just to insult you and try to tear you down because it makes them feel better about themselves, it's not someone you want in your life.
Right. And it can be hard to tell where the lines are sometimes for some people. But for you, it sounds like you could have really gone one of a number of ways. But ultimately, do you think it was, I don't know, maybe that strong German presence in your life that made you decide, you know, under all this pressure, I'm going to turn into a diamond and I'm going to work? Or was it, because that's not the usual for a lot of people. It's like the pressure comes and they're like, fuck it, I'm sleeping.
Mm. Well, the problem was, is if I were to ever be like that, if I didn't keep fighting, no one would take care of me.
Yeah.
Like, if I didn't try to get good grades, I didn't have anybody's influence to say, hey, you need to do better. There was no one around. And I didn't want to struggle more in life.
Yeah.
I wanted to succeed because I didn't have anybody on my team. I'd only had myself.
What was the drive? I mean, it's amazing.
No one there. Like, you know, if I were to fall in the gutter and be, you know, no one's going to pick me up.
Yeah.
There's no one there. So there's no one. When you really are that alone, you have to sink or swim.
Yeah.
And
you find out what you're made of when you're tested.
Yeah, and when you're tested as a small child, like, you don't have anyone, you know?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Like, seriously, like, you're starving, you're hungry. Are you just going, there's no one there to whine to. What are you going to do? Are you going to go and learn how to go cook something? Watch somebody, you know? What are you going to do? So that's what I did, is I found old cooking books. I read recipes. I tried to pick the things that were in the cupboards that, you know, we were poor.
Yeah.
But I tried to pick the things in the cupboard and cook for myself. And it's, I mean, I know my mom has a lot of regrets, but she was so stressed out. She didn't have time for me.
Yeah.
You know, like, she worked all day, came home, and just shut down. She would go in her room, talk on the phone. She wasn't worried about cooking me dinner or helping me with grades or even interacting with me. And I think she had a lot of resentment for me as a child. Because I don't think I don't think she ever wanted to be a mother. And I don't think she ever wanted to be a single mother. But I remembered as a kid kind of fighting with her and being like, why didn't you just leave me with dad? And because I didn't understand really what kind of person he was, because I was a child.
Yeah.
And she was like, there's no way I could do that.
Yeah.
And as an adult, I'm like, okay, I get it, you know? But I just had to be a stronger person. I didn't have anyone there. And I remembered at one point when I was like 16, you know, my mom had moved me from California, where I had tons of friends, and then moved me to the middle of nowhere in the Colorado mountains in Divide.
Oh, man.
It was...
That's a stark contrast.
Yes. And in California, you know, like, I had a ton of friends. I had a live-in boyfriend. You know, we used to go after school and go to the beach, like, drive a couple hours to go to Santa Cruz. You know, like, I just had a really cool life out there. I had lots of friends. Used to do bong rips every morning with my boyfriend, you know, on my way to school, and then nap through my German class, you know. And, I mean, I had several best friends. I had a really solid group of dude friends that I used to hang out with and party with. And I went from all of that to, like, once again being all alone in the mountains with no one and nothing around. And I wasn't old enough to drive. And at that point, I remember thinking, well, what if I run away from home and just, like, run away back to California, you know? And it was those, you know, I had a list, and I'm sure I could maybe even find it if I still have it. And it was pros and cons. And it was like, the reality was, is that I would have to try to see if I could get a job, but I didn't know if anyone would really hire me at how young I was, and if I would make enough money to even, like, have an apartment. And it was like, you know, who would I live with? Because at that time, right before I left California, my boyfriend had cheated on me. Because he explained was that he was devastated I was leaving, and he thought it would be better if we left with, like, something, you know, to pull us apart.
Oh, yeah. Fine.
Instead of, like, just...
Find a justification, hero.
Yeah. It was like, wow, all his stuff was in the street, so that was fun.
Yeah. But with all of this shifting landscape under your feet, I mean, a constant stream of not really being able to count on much other than yourself. It sounds like, and tell me if any of this resonates with you, but it almost sounds like the driving force behind all of this pushing you toward getting yourself together was fear.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, I can say I've been depressed my whole childhood. So
when did that start for you?
Oh, man. As a baby?
Yeah?
Yeah. Like, as young as possible.
Yeah. I mean, with your, I mean, you already said what you were dealing with your parents. I mean, you know, they say that, you know, like houseplants almost, you know, the environment under which you keep a child with, the way that human beings are sensitive to the moods of the room, if you will, the empathy that we all have tuned up to some degree or another. Mm-hmm. If you're in a situation that almost seems like danger, that's going to be, you know, like spider sense. I mean, it's just going to be way up to 11. And that can be a difficult way to navigate the world, especially as a small child, if you're not getting a lot of guidance for how to handle feelings like that beyond, let's pretend this isn't happening.
Yeah, well, I have a German mother. I mean, she's as German as they come. So, you know, if I was ever to cry about something, she would fucking smack me.
Yeah.
And be like, I'll give you something to cry about.
Right.
So you learn real quick, like, you know, you just have to bottle shit up.
Yeah.
And
tamp it down.
Yeah, I mean, and I was very depressed as a child. And I can honestly say throughout most of my life, I struggled with depression. The catalyst ended up being kind of the savior in my life was probably when I was, I think, 26. I ended up trying to take my life.
At 26.
I mean, I had sort of attempted several times, but I was
like teenage
very,
stuff.
Yeah, but really serious at 26.
Yeah.
I guess the weight of everything that I had been through in my life became too much.
Yeah.
I had a boyfriend later in high school, who I was completely madly in love with. Like we lost our virginity together. He was adorable. We were a pretty great couple. And we traveled Europe to visit my family when I was 18. I think he was 17. And when he came back, he left me. And that was really devastating. That was probably the most devastating thing out of all the things I've dealt with.
Yeah. Yeah, the end of relationships can hit you so hard. Especially at that age when you're younger, you know, people discount it, but I mean, your emotions are all such a raw nerve. You're feeling everything to its absolute fullest, including the pain.
Yeah. Well, and you know, for someone who grew up not trusting men and then to finally have a man that I did trust and, I can be honest in saying he was very good to me.
Yeah.
You know, he used to spoil me, you know, gifts all the time, always took me out to eat.
Yeah.
Or just, you know, if we were driving somewhere, he knew I liked Yoo-Hoo. He'd always stop at this one gas station just to get me a Yoo-Hoo. Like, just, he was amazing. And I completely trusted him. And I really did think that I was going to spend the rest of my life with this person. And to have that ripped away was very hard.
Are you able to find joy in any of those memories now?
Oh,
or are
yeah.
they still just kind of...
They hurt.
Mixed bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I laugh about a lot of things. You know, whenever I hear Misfits, it makes me think of him.
Yeah.
He used to always... he was like a total greaser guy. So,
yeah.
He'd always sing, if I cut off your arms and I cut off your legs, would you still love me anyways? So whenever I hear that song, it makes me smile because it, you know, it brings back like a time when I was in love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good that you can do that. I mean, that means there's been some healing.
Yeah. I mean, I can say from who I was when I was 26 to who I am now is vastly different in how I approach life and how I deal with things because, at 26-year-old me had been struggling with heartache, you know, pretty intensely. After me and him separated, you know, I became a total punk rocker, like dyed my hair pink back when that was not socially acceptable at all. And, you know, my nickname was Freak Girl. I worked at a nightclub. And, you know, I was getting through college. I was very depressed. I mean, I definitely drank and did drugs as much as possible, you know.
Right.
But it was
You're
like,
medicating.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely was like, you know, go to school during the day. So I was in college during the day to get my multimedia degree. And then at night, I worked at a nightclub I hated.
Yeah.
I hated it. And I hated all the cheesy guys hitting on me. It was pretty awful. you know, and then I would.
Do you remember any of the, like, really awesome lines that they would give you? Like the pickup lines?
No.
No?
I just remember just rolling my eyes constantly. And I actually, what I used to do, and they had a closet in the back. I used to go in there every single night and cry.
Oh, Jesus.
And I would wipe away my tears, pick myself up, put on a smile, and walk out there with a stupid tray of shots and be like, would you like a shot?
Yeah. See, even through the thing that amazes me about all of this is that, I mean, in every step of the way of this story that you're telling me about this incredibly hard life, there's never a moment up to 26 where you say, you know, and then I was done. It's always, and so then I kept moving. And I kept moving, you know, like it just, you continued to move the whole time. And that had to be keeping you alive.
Yeah. But I think when I got to about 25, like, so I was doing all that stuff, trying to get through college. My my goal was to save money to move to LA. I was modeling at the time. I thought, you know, I'm going to go to LA, I'm going to model, I'm going to go write, I'm going to work for a magazine, I'm going to have some cool-ass job.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was so not in a place where I wanted to date. Like, and it was just kind of funny because at the time, you know, the way I dressed and looked, I mean, I wore the skimpiest outfits imaginable. I wore see-through things and,
yeah,
like, stockings. Like, I just totally dressed completely different than how I was on the inside. Like, I hadn't even dated anybody for years and years. Like, I hadn't dated anybody or even had any male interaction, like, physically.
Yeah.
For years. And it was interesting. I moved to Denver when I was 21. Ended up having some friends here and decided, okay, that'll be cool. The rumors about me were ridiculous. I was like, I am, like, celibate. I was like, but that's cool. Okay, you guys just have rumors about me because I'm the new girl in town. But ended up, you know, after a few years of living in Denver, I just started running around with the bad crowd, you know? There's a lot of drugs, and then I started dating some really sketchy guys. And it's just probably because I was depressed and lonely.
Yeah.
And they were
around. I mean, damage will always find damage.
Yeah. I mean, like, every single guy, I think, from, like, 21 till I was, like, 25 was all former felon. I mean, these were really sketchy people I was dating. And I think I was kind of naive at the time because I was like, oh, no, they're really nice. You just have to get to know them. And then I would start dating him, and then, you know, next thing you know, they're calling me names and push me into walls.
Yeah.
And finally, like, at 25, I think, I started working at this place that was a really toxic environment for me. It was a HVAC company. They were, it was like an old boys club, you know? It was all the old men who were very misogynistic. I got a position there as a marketing coordinator. I really wanted to change the company around. That was my driving force, and I was constantly completely torn down because I think because I was a female.
Yeah.
And, you know, that plus the years of abuse from relationships, and I had gained a lot of weight at the time, and I wasn't used to that. Mm-hmm. I really sunk into a hole, and for about a year, I told people, everyone. I don't think I had very good friends around, to be honest. I think I had a lot of people that were fake in my life.
Yeah.
And I told people constantly, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. And never once was anybody really caring.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. Not like, do you want to talk or do you need help or what's going on? Never anybody reached out. And you know, I used to tell my mom too, like, I'm going to do this, but she doesn't know how to handle that because she's not a very emotional person.
Right. Yeah.
So finally, like, it just got to the point where I was like, I'm done. And I had gotten ditched by someone who was supposed to be a friend. because she blew me off for a guy that she was dating, but she was dating like four guys. Mm-hmm. So that really pissed me off. I was like, really? Like, I'm dressed and ready to go, and you're blowing me off because one of the four guys you're dating wants to see you. Like, that just was like, wow, I don't matter at all.
Yeah.
And it was just like, if I don't matter at all, why am I here? So I walked down to the store, and I got a bottle of, like, the only... I had to think of, like, the worst liquor, I guess. And yeah. I was like, what is something I could do shots of that's not, like, straight vodka?
Right.
Or, like, straight tequila. And so I got a bottle of Jaeger. I hate Jaeger.
Of course.
I don't even like
yeah.
it. And I was like, I'm going to drink this bottle of Jaeger, and I'm going to take all the pills in my house, and I have a gun just in case. So I called my mom halfway through consciousness and told her, like, this is what I'm doing. And she lived 2.5 hours away. So she said, leave your door open. And I was like, why? And I didn't really understand what she was saying because I was also not very coherent. I left, like, a suicide note on my computer. I woke up on the floor of my apartment with the police there. And that, it's like, the worst part was not trying to kill myself. The worst part ended up being what the police did to me. They brutalized me. And waking up in the hospital, knowing what they had done to me, made me be like, okay, you have two options. You either get better and never get to this point again, or next time you do it properly with the gun and don't tell anybody. And I ended up...
Tissues right there.
Yeah. I ended up being like, I really want to change my life. You know, I need to change everybody I'm around. There's a bigger world out there, and I need to have better people in my life.
Yeah.
I need to find joy.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if it's just that I put the message out there in the world, or if right after surviving that, literally, like, you know, the next week after that, being like, fuck it, I don't give any fucks anymore.
Yeah.
ended up having a friend that moved out from California to live with me temporarily until she was able to get an apartment. And having someone around was good. And then, you know, it still was like a week of her living with me until I confessed, like, hey, just 2 weeks ago, like, I tried to kill myself. And she was just like, I can't believe you didn't say anything. And I'm like, well, I feel like nobody cares anyways.
Yeah.
So,
that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand about a person when they hit that spot of deciding to go forward with suicide. It's usually, it's usually like, you know, I liken it to when on 9/11, people were jumping from the buildings.
Yeah.
Because that's what they saw their options as. You see your very reality as, I'm in a burning building and I can either stay here and burn, which will be worse.
Yeah.
Or I can, you know, preserve some of this, or I can avoid some pain, or, you know, I don't see a way out of this beyond where we are right now. So I'm going to jump and I'm going to hope that I land somewhere better than this. Or, you know, thankfully nowhere at all.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to hope that I'd never open my eyes again, that I'm doing the same thing I was doing before I was born.
Yeah.
And I can only hope for that. Like, this is what I got. This is what I did with it. And there's no more time to think this through because the flames are coming.
Yeah.
And people don't recognize that. It's easy to tell someone what the other part of the reality is. You know, stand back, look at the larger view, look at the choices you still have available. But none of that is there when you feel the fire on your back.
Yeah.
And it's not really even a matter of necessarily cowardice or weakness or, you know, honestly, there's, it's terrifyingly brave to make the decision that I'm going to go out and I'm going to go out on my own terms. But it's also incredibly short-sighted because you're incapable of seeing the future yourself in that moment. It's a hard thing to impress upon people. And to come out the other side of it as a survivor of yourself, especially after what was done to you, to come out the other end and have a resolve, you know, I've seen where this can go.
Yeah.
It's time to try something different. You're putting yourself back in the universe with intention after having spent so much time learning to tread water. You're now building your life raft instead of treading water.
Yeah. And you know, you know, I don't talk about it very often or even ever really about my suicide attempt. But I can say that I think that that sort of saved my life.
Yeah.
Because I just sort of knew that like nothing could ever be as bad as that.
Yeah.
And that I had to try to, you know, become a happier person, like try to find some sort of happiness. And having, you know, that new friend, or I guess an older friend that came back into my life, you know, cracking jokes and just having someone around, that helped. And then, you know, like almost like the universe heard my call, a man entered my life at that point who was super funny and silly, and we used to be just the most silly, obnoxious pair. We had so much fun, just the two of us.
Yeah.
We didn't even need to be at a bar or out in public. We would just be completely silly goofballs with each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, having that person in my life really changed my life because it made me be like, this is who I am. This is who I am. This is who I forgot I could be.
Yeah.
Is like a funny, silly, you know, happy person. And even though, you know, that person did heavily betray me and my trust, after about a year, they did shine a lot of light into my life. And it helped to mold my life. And actually after that split, I was tested heavily. I was assaulted. And from that, I remembered, you know, kind of telling someone like about my struggles, and they said to me, well, have you ever like done, I think it was Dharma punks. And I was like, what is that? And because I'd never heard of it. And they're like, how have you not heard of this? They're like, you kind of are into Buddhism. They're like, but you've never heard of this movement? I'm like, no. So basically it's punk rock Buddhism.
Yeah.
It's taking, you know, Buddhism and relating it to modern culture, modern life. A lot of people that who struggle with addiction really follow the Dharma Punks way, which they have groups called Against the Stream.
Yeah.
And I ended up randomly going online, like when they mentioned it to me, and looking, and Noah Levine, who's the founder of that movement, ended up was going to be in Colorado the next week. So I begged my mom, do you have $700? Please, can you buy me this retreat? Like, I need this. I was still hurting from being assaulted. You know, the man I loved had left me. It had only been like a year and a half since my suicide attempt. I was like, I just need to go someplace and try to heal from everything I've been through. And it ended up being really good for me. And, I took a lot of things from there. You know, some of the things were a lot of Buddhist principles, like, you know, not everything is always good or bad. Not everything's black and white. So, you know, if you have a bad day, doesn't mean a good day's not coming around the corner.
Sure.
And there's kind of that middle path that, you know, that if you can ground yourself in the middle and know that bad and good can happen, but, you know, they're always going to offset each other.
Yeah. Well, there's bad and there's good. And then what are you going to do?
Yeah. So utilizing a lot of those Buddhist principles has really helped me a lot. And when I think about who I was at 26 versus 10 years later, who I am now.
Yeah.
I'm definitely like a much stronger person. I handle things much more differently than I would have back then. I used to let things crush me.
Yeah.
And things don't crush me like they used to. I kind of am always like, well, this is very painful and this is very hard, but you know what? It will get better. And kind of living my life with that mentality has really helped a lot. You know, I haven't had those drastic lows like I once had. I feel like, you know, and I know people diss on it, but I've also went on medication probably, I don't know, within the last 4 years, 5 years maybe.
Yeah.
And even though it's been 10 years since that, I think that also was the extra push I needed just to help with being able to cope with life.
Just kind of helped even things out while you were figuring.
Yeah.
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 I went back on medication again now, too.
Yeah.
After 15 years without it. And here I am.
Do you feel better?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I really do. I also did decide to do it the wrong way. You know, again, on my own terms.
Okay.
But because I'm bipolar, so mm-hmm. I should be on an antidepressant and a mood stabilizer.
Yes.
I said no to the mood stabilizer.
Why was that?
Because I want the roller coaster.
You really?
Yeah.
So you and do you?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Because I spent so long learning how to deal with it.
Okay.
I just needed a life preserver, not a boat.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, give me the antidepressant. I want to see if it works by itself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the high highs and low lows, me and my dark passenger, I mean, we're such good friends. Like I recognize it when it's there. I'm, you know, I've spent my entire life trying to build myself into the kind of person who could survive on a desert island without killing myself. And it took a lot of work to get to that point. And I'm very fucking proud of getting to that point.
Yeah, it was so hard work. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got there, but I needed a life preserver because I was sinking.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want the mood stabilizer. I don't want to feel like I've got a ceiling on me. I know what works for me. And so I'm going to trust my own instincts. And I made the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, because when my mania hits, I'm aware of it. And so I'm like, okay, we got to be cool because otherwise, you know, we're not Jesus and we're not going to go, you know, tear apart the washing machine to find out how it works at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do something properly constructive.
Yeah.
You know, let's write some music. Let's, you know, build a podcast studio. I mean,
focus your energy.
Yeah. Focus the energy on something positive and be aware that this energy is mania. And it's going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, don't bite off more than you can chew. And enjoy it while it lasts. And recognize that a low that is equal and opposite is probably around the corner. And be ready for it. And I mean, that's a difficult thing to do.
Mm.
And I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So the antidepressant's been enough for me. What are you currently doing?
So I'm on something that's just a serotonin booster.
Yeah.
So it's not an antidepressant per se. It's something that aids in sleep. Nice. And helps boost my serotonin.
Yeah.
So I still feel
need?
Very human.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I'm a bit happier. I mean, I can definitely tell when I'm like kind of losing it. Like I have a very high stress career right now.
Yeah.
And you know, this week I realized I was kind of ranting about work a bit much, and I had to like step back and be like, "Whoa, I'm turning into my mom. Gotta stop doing that." And it took a friend telling me like, "Breathe, calm down, breathe. Like it will be better." And it just, you know, that helped. And then yesterday I went to work and I was fine. I was able to get through my day and conquer the day, even though they did fire someone at my office. I ended up being like, oh, that sucks. Okay, I got to get my work done. Like, still went about my day and didn't let it crush me or anything or really impact me in the ways that I would have expected, you know, 10 years ago. So I think medication is really important just to kind of help you become the person you want to be.
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily changes people. It just helps them balance out
Yeah. If you get the right cocktail, it's incredibly helpful.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a couple friends in my life that are, you know, that they take medication, and I have a couple friends where I'm like, I really feel like you would be a happier person if you were to get that medication.
You probably should.
Yeah. You probably need that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, anybody, when you're struggling with different things, whether it's mental illness or maybe you had a really rough life, you know, and that can be hard on you, but you know, I think with the proper tools, you know, medication, I think meditation.
Meditation's huge.
Huge.
That one's hard for me.
It's hard for a lot of people. It's like you have monkey mind. It's hard to calm it. But I think if you, they always say your time on the mat. So if you get on that mat and you sit there and you do that meditation, you usually end up feeling so much better.
Yeah.
Giving
yourself over to something.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm not a religious person, but the idea of giving yourself over to meditation, because you have to give in. You can't wait for the meditation to do its work, because you're the one doing the work, and the work is to let the meditation happen. Let yourself breathe. Let yourself get into that space where you're not, you know, yelling at yourself that you should be doing something. You know, the moment my mind goes quiet, all of the voices come in, and none of them are helpful.
Yeah, monkey mind is a real problem, as you know, when you're trying to meditate. There was a, you know, I really became fascinated with the brain a couple years ago, because I still have some residual, you know, emotions, I guess, from when I was at a really low point that could pop up, and a couple of different things, like I have attachment issues, so either I don't get very attached to someone, and then other people I get extremely attached to.
Yeah.
And then I'm devastated when they're not in my life.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was a point where I was like, why am I so completely, like, devastated over somebody that's been in my life for, like, 3 months? Mm-hmm. You know? Like, why? And I ended up doing a lot of research on the mind. And you know, and in my quest for knowledge, on why I felt the way I did and just, you know, how the human mind works, a couple things I learned was that they said negative thinking rewires your brain in a certain pattern. So if someone is prone to negative thinking, right? Like something bad happens, like, oh, this always happens to me, or this is all my fault, or just those negative thoughts that come in, they said there's three different ways to correct that. It is training of the mind.
Yeah.
Medication, meditation, and cognitive therapy are the only three things that have shown to help rewire the brain towards positive thinking.
Yes.
And I have studied that and worked a lot on my negative thinking. Because there was a point where if, you know, something happened in my life...
Sorry. So sorry.
No worries. There was a point where if something happened in my life, I immediately thought that I wasn't worthy of love. And that is negative thinking. And I had to rewire my brain. And now I know I am worthy of love.
Yeah.
And I know that I am worthy of someone who loves and appreciates me for who I am and who sees my strength and adores that about me. You know, like, we all want to be loved.
Yeah.
But, you know, it took me a long time to rewire my brain from thinking no one will ever love me to I deserve love.
Yeah. Well, you spent so much time just trying to keep yourself stable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of time for reflection when you have to keep moving like a shark or you're going to die.
Yeah. It's a, you know, I definitely think my fight or flight response is very strong, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I've had someone, like, you know, I guess a girl I was friends with, like, came up behind me and kind of tugged on my hair, and I immediately was about to turn around and punch them. And it wasn't even a thought.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh my God, are you going to punch me? I was like, yeah. Why did you pull my hair? She's like, I thought it was funny. I'm like, please don't do that. You don't know what someone's been through in their life.
Yeah.
If I feel like I'm being physically threatened in any way, especially if I don't see who it is.
You're after, going down.
Yeah. After the things I've been through, it's like my immediate response is to defend myself.
Yeah.
And that's just probably from, you know, being assaulted, you know, a few years back, and the abuse I saw, you know, my mother entail.
Yeah.
So it's definitely like, you know, I don't have a good response that's like, run away. Like, that's not my response. I think my response typically is to fight.
Yeah.
After everything I've been through. Even when I want to give up, I know that if I give up, there's no one there to help me.
Yeah.
If a job gets too hard, I can't just give up. I got to keep working.
Yeah.
Because I need to pay my bills. I need to make sure I have a roof over my head because there's nobody that will catch me if I fall.
Well, and that's so evident in every step of your development as a person. You know, for your story, as you've told it, it's so obvious. You're a fighter.
Yeah. Well, I got that from my mother.
Yeah.
She's a fighter too. Very strong woman.
So how are you and your mom now? You good?
Yeah, we're really close friends, to be honest. Anybody who knows me, like, usually my mom's around. Like, she's a very eccentric, she stands out in a crowd. She's got big red curly hair. She's, you know, thick German accent. You know, I think my mom, you know, she's had her own struggles. She had cancer a few years back. That was really difficult on me as the sole provider to take care of her during that time she moved in with me in my one-bedroom apartment. She survived that. And she was honestly, I think, not a happy person before that. And I had to have a lot of tough love towards her and be like, look, you need to lighten up. And
yeah.
You need to be a happier person. Like, you're a survivor. But, I mean, what's the point if you're not happy? And I think that some of the, you know, I made her go to therapy with, like, as family therapy, so me and her.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it really did help because I think now she appreciates things that I don't think she ever paid attention to. But now she's always like, oh, you know, like, this is so beautiful. And, oh, I love my home. And, oh, I love my cat. Like, you know, and my mother was never someone to be like, she never told me she loved me as a child. And even as an adult, it's not like the most common thing to hear from her. But it does happen more now.
Yeah.
But also I just hear her saying more positive things. Because I've also told her for years I can't stand her complaining and things like that. And, you know, I've also told her, like, you have to rewire your brain. You have to rewire it to be a more positive person.
Yeah.
Because that's who I want in my life. I mean, with all the struggles I've been through, I know that my mental health is always going to really be impacted by the energy of other people. So I can't be around a lot of negative energy because it does tear me down. It does get to me. And so for my own mental health, I know that I have to be surrounded by other like-minded, positive people. I mean, we all have our struggles. We all go through things. But if you're going to make everything in your life a struggle, you know, if you're like, this guy cut me off in traffic, I'm like, people cut me off all the time.
Yeah.
Just flip him off and go about your day. Like,
right.
You know, but some people just, they can't let things go. Little things that happen throughout the day just ruin their day.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that's more about them. It's not about what happened to them.
Exactly. And it's a negative thinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're surrounded by somebody who constantly, for every little thing, is just seeing the most negative, you know, side of everything, it really eats away at you.
Yeah.
And it gets to the point where you're like, I have to distance myself, you know, for my own mental health. And so I can say that I don't have a ton of close friends, but the ones I have are some of the most strongest, some of the most amazing, beautiful people I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
My best friend is a badass. She's she said, like, there's, like, no women in her field. She's, I think, a production manager or something. She works in the car industry in auto body and for a big, large facility. And she's basically running the place right now.
Yeah.
Top of her field. And, you know, she's, like, you know, got a kid and she's just does Muay Thai, like everything you could imagine. Like, I'm just always inspired by this beautiful human, you know?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to be very inspired by you.
Aw.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Vanessa Hart, everybody. Can you believe it? That was a really, really intense story to cram into an hour. I got so many questions. There are so many other things that I want to know. If you want to know more, you can find Vanessa on Facebook. There are links at the Coffee Over Suicide Facebook page. And speaking of the Coffee Over Suicide, get yourself to coffeeoversuicide.com and click on the shopping cart and get some stickers or a coffee mug or a t-shirt. It helps me keep the lights on. Also, premiering out of this very studio in the next couple of weeks is Let's Laugh About Death, the dramedy podcast that celebrates life while contemplating the inevitable with host Tim Rooney. But until then, don't kill yourselves out there.